You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Blessed above all of creation, it was a rare and precious pearl. Conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free, it was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. The reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize, confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid the child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand.
Today we're going to have another great program with some really, really great guests. I've got John F. McManus. He was the past president for a very long time of the John Birch Society. And I have William F. Jasper, who is the editor for the New American Magazine. And we're going to be talking about the global conspiracy. And we're going to be talking about theory versus facts. I want to lead into this program with a kind of an overview of the way I was introduced to the Birch Society. In 2008, actually, on my way flying to St. Louis to see my son, daughter-in-law, and their kids, and talk to the family out there about what I saw coming in the financial markets and in the world of finance and how we were on the verge of a collapse. I had written a letter to him in early January. It was about a 10-page letter outlining what derivatives were, what the whole financial system was built on, the shifting sand of our financial system. And I'd written that after we had been together in 2007 for Christmas with the whole family. And I told the whole family, you better buckle up because we're going to be in a serious financial mess this year coming up. So you better get your financial house in order. And I explained to them what was going on. Well, anyway, my son asked me to write a letter about that, which I did. I put together about a 10-page letter. It was about as a lengthy and explanatory in great detail how the whole system was structured. And I sent it to the family, the whole family and a number of friends. And my son contacted me. He said, Dad, would you come out and spend some time and talk to my friends and my family out here in the St. Louis area? His in-laws and the family out there. And if you will, I would really appreciate it. So I did that. When I was in the airport on the way to St. Louis, I happened to pick up a magazine called The New American because it had a picture of a house floating off the ground and it said the upcoming financial crisis. And I thought, wow, somebody's got it figured out. That was the first indication of any major publication having a clue what was going on in our financial industry. I read the magazine. I immediately subscribed to the New American because I thought, wow, these people really know what they're doing. I then later had an opportunity to see John McManus when he spoke at the Campaign for Liberty event that was held at the Target Center in Minneapolis when Ron Paul was running for president. And I said, man, these people have really got their act together. I had listened to a lot of the same garbage and propaganda that many other people, I'm sure, have heard over the years. These people are right-wing nuts. They're extremists and all this stuff. Well, guess what? When I started to really look into the Birch Society and really understand how good these people really are at predicting exactly what's been happening in America, I was absolutely amazed and I was absolutely impressed. And with that, I've gotten to know some of the top leadership of the Birch Society. And I've even been at several of their major conventions. And all I can say is, gentlemen, you are fantastic. John, I know you're probably on the call right now. I hope also that Bill is on. I'd love to give you guys an opportunity to talk a little bit about the Birch Society, and then let's start talking about what conspiracy theories, fact and fiction, are really all about. John, are you on, please?
He may need to hit *6 on his phone there to unmute his microphone there.
Okay.
Yes, wonderful. It's good to speak to you again. We get a chance to visit occasionally, but I'm always amazed with what an honor it is to have you on the radio. Thank you, John, for being here.
Well, Dan, let me start off by saying that back in the early 60s, I, too, was influenced by the propaganda against the John Birch Society. But I decided to go to a meeting, and I bought some books. I started looking into it. I met a couple of members of the Birch Society. And before too long, I realized that I had been had, and I decided to join the society as far back as 1964. And then I joined the staff in 66 and served in various capacities, including nationwide public relations director, and eventually became president. I'm now president emeritus. I'm in my closed down years, I guess we could say, although I still do some writing. So I have great empathy for anybody who was an enemy of the Birch Society, who took a look at what it really was and found out the truth. And happily, there are more people doing exactly that, even as we speak. So it's a delight to be with you. And I can talk about a lot of different subjects. I'm going to ask you to lead me and tell me what you want to talk about.
Okay, well, I'll certainly do that. And I have to say, John, I've had opportunity to meet you in person, visit with you in person up in Montana. And you are really an amazing man. Your overview of America, we were doing programs up in Montana, and we opened every program with a 20-minute segment of overview of America. That is probably the best single, very short, but very concise description of why America is special. And you're the one that produced that, and that's absolutely amazing. So,
thank you. Thank you for that.
Oh, it's fantastic, I have to tell you. And you're a fantastic gentleman. I want to talk, what our program is about today is I want to talk about the global conspiracy, because we keep hearing for decades, we've heard about these conspiracy theories and all these crazy radical ideas that people on the right are talking about. I want to talk about what is theory and what is fact. Let's start talking about just exactly how deep this global conspiracy is, how it started, and where we're at today.
Well, where it started was in the Garden of Eden, as far back as that, thousands of years ago. Good. So bringing it up to modern times, I think probably a good place to start would be the so-called Enlightenment, in Europe of Rousseau, Voltaire, and a whole bunch of others. They took over a civilized society, and they started getting people thinking wrongly and hating, especially hating the Catholic Church. And from them came the Illuminati conspiracy beginning in 1776, moved on into Europe, all over Europe, even had a branch here in America. And the goal was a new world order. The goal was socialism and world government. And that's what we face today. Modern parts of the conspiracy we're talking about would include the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberger Group, the Trilateral Commission, and a whole bunch of other things. The Council on Foreign Relations was started in New York City in 1921, and there are now counterparts of the Council on Foreign Relations in Europe, and in Canada, and in other countries. And these people are determined. They're hell-bent on getting everybody to be a slave. They want socialism and world government, and they're proceeding as if nobody seemed to care. Well, the John Birch Society did begin to care, and that's what invited the smear attempt to knock us out of business. Came close to doing just that, but it didn't, thanks to the leadership of Robert Welch, the man who founded the society, and his foresight. He knew that getting something started to keep the American people informed about what was really happening would attract a lot of nasty attention. And boy, it certainly did come. Yeah. As you said, it affected you, Dan. It certainly affected me. And some of our best members all across the country have been people who were former enemies of the John Birch Society until they were shown the truth. And people who have a good backbone are people who say, well, I was snookered once, and I'm not going to get snookered again. So how do you get in John Birch Society? And we're glad to have them.
Well, you certainly made a believer out of me, I have to tell you. One thing I want to talk about, who is John Birch?
Oh, that's a good question, and it deserves an answer, certainly. John Birch was a young Christian missionary from Georgia who went to China in 1940. Now, in 1940, the Japanese had already invaded China, and the war between the Chinese and Japanese was already underway. But the Japanese had more ambitions, as we found out on December 7th of 1941, when the terrible attack at Pearl Harbor occurred. And now the United States, was now at war. And of course, because Germany and Italy had signed a pact with Japan, and the pact said, if you go to war, we'll be with you. Then we went to war with Japan, and immediately Germany and Italy were at war with us. So we had war on two fronts. But get back to John Birch. Here he was in 1940, going about missionary work for the Baptist Church and being quite successful at it. When in early 1942, the famous raid over Tokyo, conducted by General Jimmy Doolittle and some brave people, a couple of dozen American bombers left off aircraft carriers in the South Pacific and flew to Japan to drop some bombs on Tokyo and let the Japanese know that there was going to be a response to what they did at Pearl Harbor. So this was only a few months after Pearl Harbor. Now, the people in those planes were all told that they would obviously run out of fuel and they couldn't get back to where they had started, and there was no place for them to land safely, so they were told to fly their planes to interior China, go as far as you could, and when you ran out of fuel or about to run out of fuel, parachute out of the plane and let the plane go. And they did. And so Jimmy Doolittle, Colonel at the time, he was the leader of one of the planes, he and his crew gathered together after having parachuted and they were hiding in a barge alongside a waterway in a small community, and hoping to find some Americans, when a man who had seen them, maybe even talked to them, went to John Birch, who was having dinner in a small cafe all by himself. And the man said, "If you're an American, come outside. I need to talk to you." So John finished his meal and went outside, and the man told him, "There are Americans in that barge over there." And he pointed to it, and then he left. So John went over and knocked on the door. "Are there any Americans in there?" And one of Doolittle's men said, "Don't open it. It's a trap." And John kept pounding the door. "Are there any Americans in there?" And finally, one of Doolittle's men said, "There isn't anybody in China who can speak English with a southern U.S. accent. It has to be an American." And so he opened the door, and that's how they met. John Birch met General Doolittle and his crew, who was colonel at the time, and brought them back into safety with the American forces in China. And John Birch became a hero for doing that. But when he met General Claire Chennault, who was the head of the Flying Tiger organization, General Chennault said, "I'd like you to join our forces." And John said, "I'd be happy to do that. I want to be your chaplain." And Chennault said, "I already have a chaplain, but I need you. I need an American who speaks the language, who can do intelligence work for me." And John accepted, was commissioned as a lieutenant in the United States Army Air Corps in July 4th of 1942. He then served with absolute distinction, an amazing individual. Everybody in the American forces in China during that period had heard about this John Birch guy, and everybody who had met him was as impressed as anybody should have been. And so John Birch was reporting on troop movements of the Japanese. He was reporting on their bases, where they were, even looking off the coast and seeing ship movements and so on. And John did incredible work. He should have been given a Congressional Medal of Honor, but he never did get that. Now, the war ended in August of 1945. And finally, John was sent on a mission 10 days later to find out if these troops that were nearby were friend or foe. Well, he went up and he met the troops, and he found out that they were communist troops, part of Mao Zedong's forces at the time. There actually were three participants in the war in China: the Chinese nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek, the Chinese communists under Mao Zedong, and the American forces and the Chinese American forces that were helping the good guys, the Chinese nationalists. So anyhow, John went on the mission to find out if this group of troops were friend or foe, and it turned out that they were communist forces of Mao Zedong, and they killed John Birch. He had a Chinese officer with him who was also attacked and given up for dead, but managed to survive. And he told what had happened about John Birch and how he had died. Well, Robert Welch, an American businessman, the Welch Candy Company, in fact, had heard something about the story of John Birch, did some digging, got some help from Senator William Noland in California, and he finally wrote a book in 1954 called The Life of John Birch, a small book, only 100 pages long, about a real American hero. And 4 years later, Robert Welch decided to form an organization to inform the American people about what was really happening and to expose a conspiracy that meant to rule the world. So he did form it in a meeting held in Indianapolis, Indiana, in December of 1958, and the John Birch Society was born. And it didn't take too long, as I've already explained, for the society to be discovered. And when it was discovered, then we could probably say all hell broke loose. The John Birch Society was accused of every nasty thing you could possibly imagine. It was anti-Semitic. It was racist. It was even communist. Anything that was nasty that would resound to the American people was said about the Birch Society. Now, amazingly, the good feeling, the good sense of a lot of Americans said, if that organization is as bad as it is, I got to take a look at it. I got to see it and prevent it from having any buildup in my community. So a lot of people wrote to the Birch Society and asked for information. And when they got the information, they were stunned. And then they got more information. Then they joined the society. Then they built a chapter of the society. The greatest growth of the John Birch Society occurred in the early 1960s, and it was due to being attacked. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1966, I guess it was, all of a sudden the other side began to realize that their attacking of the Birch Society was being counterproductive. So they stopped. And pretty soon, the John Birch Society wasn't in the news anymore, or it hadn't been for a year or more. And then it became a difficult period. But the society survived and has led the fight against a lot of initiatives that would have been harmful to our country. We succeeded in quite a few, and we haven't succeeded in all of what we've tried to do. But we're still at it. We have members of the society and all 50 states, and some foreign countries, by the way, and we continue to work. So there's a short glimpse about who John Birch was, how he became the symbol for the society. I had the pleasure years later of visiting with John Birch's parents at their home in Macon, Georgia, and it was a delight to do that. Mr. and Mrs. Birch were amazing people. They believed that their son died for good cause, and that they were pleased that the society had chosen him as a symbol for the organization. Both of them, George and Ethel Birch, went across the country to many different locations to speak at Birch Society gatherings, Birch Society banquets, big dinners and so forth, and they were wonderful people. They're both passed away, of course, by now, but it was a delight for me to spend a little time with them and get to know them.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, I have to say, I've gotten to know you, I've gotten to know Bill Jasper, I've gotten to know how really, truly dedicated you are to the restoration of our constitutional republic. I want to give the call to Bill for a bit, because I want him to talk about how you folks got tuned in on the UN and how much the UN has impacted our national and international policy and why it's such a deadly evil against the United States. Bill, welcome to the radio program. Please pipe in on that, if you would, please.
Again, I think Bill needs to hit *6 on his device there to unmute his microphone.
Hey, Bill, are you there?
I'm there. Are we working through here now?
Yeah,
okay,
you sure
Dan.
Are.
All right, Dan, take it over. Nice to talk to you, Bill.
It's such an honor to be on with my good friend and mentor, Jack McManus, as well. We don't talk that often anymore. We're on the opposite ends of the coast. We're surrounding the country here, so we need to get together more often, Jack.
So yes, we do. Yes, we do.
I thank Dan Happel for allowing us to get together like this. So.
Okay. Now, Dan wants you to talk about the UN.
So you start,
and then I'll chime in when anything you forgot.
Okay. Well, that's a lot, you know, because as I get up in age here, I have fewer brain cells to rub together, and so I need someone like you looking after me, a youngster like yourself.
Yeah, you're a youngster. I got 20 years on you, you rascal.
Yeah, well, hopefully I'll still be working away like you are when I get up there to your age. The United Nations is, of course, one of my favorite places in the world. I say that, of course, rather facetiously. It was the United Nations and the Federal Reserve were two of our beloved institutions that brought me into this freedom fight and into the John Birch Society. I thought that both of those institutions were wonderful, necessary, important institutions for our freedom, prosperity, and well-being. And it was when I was confronted by the information of the John Birch Society that I began to realize that isn't the case. And are we still coming through okay there, sound-wise?
Yep, you're doing great, Bill. Just keep going. Yep.
Okay. So that was when I was in college 45 years ago. One of my first occupations in the Birch Society and the New American Magazine, well, before the New American, when it was American Opinion Magazine, was to cover the United Nations. And I began going to the United Nations in New York 40 years ago, I guess it was, more than 40 years ago. And so for about over 30 years, I was an accredited correspondent at the United Nations. I went there many times usually for all of their major summits and conferences on the International Year of the Child, the Millennium Summit, the Treaty for the International Criminal Court in Rome, many others that they have held in New York City or in San Francisco or in Rio de Janeiro or Rome or Copenhagen, and other places around the world. And the United Nations, I quickly found, is not the wonderful Center for World Brotherhood that we are taught in our textbooks and in our civics classes in high school and in college. Quite to the contrary, as my books and articles over the year, and as John McManus has pointed out in many of his talks and lectures and articles, the United Nations is a global threat to mankind. It is not mankind's last best hope for peace. It is the world structure for a world government, a world tyranny. And that was the subject of my first book in 1992, Global Tyranny, Step by Step, the United Nations and the Emerging New World Order. Long title, I know, title and subtitle, but it was hard to wrap it up in anything less than that. The United Nations is the instrument that globalists who want world government plan to use, and its subsidiaries and its many appendages, to create a global tyranny. And so I wrote that first book just after I had come back from the first United Nations Earth Summit. And that was the United Nations Earth Summit on Global Sustainability. So now, all these many years later, we find that sustainability is the watchword, the byword everywhere one goes. That's where it came out of, the United Nations Summit on Sustainability, the Earth Summit, clear back in 1992 when George H.W. Bush the Senior, was President of the United States. And he signed us on to a bunch of the treaties that came out of that summit. That was the summit. I was there when Fidel Castro came into the General Assembly of the Earth Summit, and it just broke out in pandemonium, in tumultuous praise for him. Viva Fidel, viva Fidel. It went on and on. And it seemed everyone except myself in the whole Earth Summit General Assembly was ecstatic at being able to welcome Fidel Castro, the communist dictator of Cuba, the revolutionary terrorist leader worldwide, the drug runner worldwide, welcoming him to the Earth Summit. And what was particularly alarming and nauseating to me was that it was not just all of the participants there, the NGOs and the delegates, but the press corps as well, virtually an American press as well. Here you had the New York Times, Associated Press, PBS, all these folks there. They're all joined in jumping up and down and praising Fidel Castro. That's what we have come to expect at the United Nations. Those of us who've been on the inside and have observed this over and over and over again. One of the other stars of that conference, he was a co-chairman of it, was Mikhail Gorbachev. He also was welcomed with tumultuous applause there. And out of that, he and Maurice Strong, who was the chairman of the Earth Summit there, Maurice Strong, the billionaire Canadian globalist one-worlder, they put together the Earth Charter, which is the new Ten Commandments for the Earth. And they inaugurated their Earth-worshipping, Gaia-worshipping, New Age, pagan theology inaugurated there at the Earth Summit, which we have seen reenacted at all of the other UN globalist green conferences and summits. That's where we saw this really originating. And now it has permeated all of the governments of the world. It's worked its way down into all of the schools so that now we have all of this focus on climate change, on overpopulation, on all of the supposed environmental existential threats to humanity, which demand that the United Nations come in and save us with programs that mandate all individual activity and all individual living arrangements and whatnot worldwide. So that's just one aspect of the United Nations, of course, which is huge. The environmental aspect of it, where they are claiming that we must have global solutions to what they say are global crises, and this can only be operationally conducted through the United Nations overseeing all of this. And that's why in the Paris Accord, for instance, and in all of the other UN environmental accords and human rights accords, you have UN monitoring arrangements where all nations are required to report every year on their monitoring, on making the achieving the United Nations benchmarks. And of course, they don't, right now they don't have the enforcement teeth that they want, but that's beyond the planning stage. It's already in the developmental stage. Once the United Nations, if we allow it, to receive police and military powers beyond what they have already, we will see then the iron fist within the velvet glove of the United Nations.
Mm-hmm. Bill, I would like to kind of go back a little bit just to help build the framework for the United Nations so our audience really understands just how deep the communist roots of the UN are. Let's go back to 1945 and Alger Hiss and the Dumbarton Oaks Conference, and how agents that were supposedly representing the United States' best interests were actually communist agents or influenced by the Council on Foreign Relations, which Jack talked about a little bit earlier, and kind of build the framework for how the United Nations really was put in place as a we'll call it a bulwark of communism worldwide.
Well, that is a very big story, and that was the story incorporated in several chapters in my books. And of course, I built upon what G. Edward Griffin in The Fearful Master and what Jack and others had written in previous things. So I don't know what all was covered in the first minutes before I was able to get online and get through my technical problems. But here's a very crucial thing for your listeners to understand, and that is that the United Nations was designed by communists. I mean, and when we use that term, we're very specific about that. These are identified, self-confessed, or publicly identified communists, such as Alger Hiss, Henry Julian Wadley, Harry Dexter White, at a number of different Nathan Gregory Silvermaster. I give a whole list in both of my books of the outed communists who were in our government. This was during the Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman administrations, mostly during the Roosevelt administration. He brought hundreds of communists into the government, many of them put in high-level cabinet positions, and others who were not actual communists themselves, but who were very friendly to and totally sympathetic with. And so they were very, very important. The most critical one, of course, in the government being Alger Hiss, who was, of course, publicly identified, and he went to prison for lying about his for perjury, but he should have gone to prison for his treason working for Joseph Stalin. He was the primary individual involved in setting up the United Nations at the conference in San Francisco in 1945. He was also the key one at the Dumbarton Oaks and Bretton Woods conferences. But not only him, we had Harry Dexter White, who became the first head of the International Monetary Fund. He was a out-and-out communist. He was working for the KGB. Alger Hiss was actually working for the GRU, the military intelligence of the Soviet Union, but they're both adjuncts of Stalin. So there were Soviet agents in our government. And there were a host of others as well. But the key thing that is even more important than that is that these high-level communists in our government were being protected by and promoted by people in our government who were not communists, at least had no public record trail showing them to be communists. In fact, many of them were top capitalists, big Wall Street bankers. And so, for instance, when we and Wall Street attorneys, like, for instance, John Foster Dulles, big Wall Street banking attorney, was a big legal counsel for the major banks in New York City. He was the one who sponsored and protected Alger Hiss, and after he left the after he was booted out of government when his communist pedigree was known, he was put in as president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace by John Foster Dulles. Now, Wikipedia and all of our textbooks will tell us that John Foster Dulles and his brother, Alan Dulles, were hardcore Cold Warrior anti-communists. That's the line they give us. That isn't true. Everything they did in their whole life shows that they were working to promote communism and to undermine our allies who were really, truly fighting against communism. So, yes, to cover their trail, they made all kinds of anti-communist speeches, all kinds of anti-communist statements, and the lazy and or complicit historians and journalists use those statements to promote that fiction, that lie, that they were solid Cold Warriors, anti-communist, pro-American. They were not. The Alger Hiss episode is just one of many. We had many members of the Council on Foreign Relations, which I understand Jack has already mentioned. But Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, as I reported recently in our article in the New American History article on the League of Nations were two of the very critical people, individuals involved in pushing forward the League of Nations and helping to write the charter for the League of Nations, which was the predecessor of the United Nations. And it failed because there were enough Americanists in Congress, and particularly in the Senate, and even in some of the media at that time, who saw the League of Nations and the charter for the League of Nations as what it really was, which was an attack on our national sovereignty and an attempt to set up a global government. And so when that failed, that's when the Council on Foreign Relations was recognized as being needed to organize American opinion in favor of internationalism, in favor of globalism, in favor of ditching our national sovereignty. And so Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, who are two of the big promoters of communism in our government and communists in our government, were two of the founders of the Council on Foreign Relations. And I should also mention, just so it doesn't get forgotten, and we can go into it a little bit more later, the founding of the United Nations here in the United States, in the form of the actual building, which is the United Nations headquarters on Turtle Bay in New York City in Manhattan, was donated, of course, by the Rockefeller family. The most well-known capitalist Wall Street dynastic banking family. And they actually paid to get the headquarters started here. They wanted the pro-communist United Nations to be headquartered here in the United States so that they would be able to use it both as a wedge to bring in many different subversives, because everybody who comes into the United States as a United Nations ambassador or other United Nations diplomatic personnel have diplomatic immunity, and they would be able to facilitate the espionage and subversion and propaganda here in the United States under the protection of diplomatic immunity. They also wanted the headquarters of the United Nations to be in New York, because that was the big publishing and newspaper and media and the growing radio and television capital. So they would be able to then feed all of the globalist pro-UN propaganda directly into the media and get it out to all of the American public. So that was very important for them in that regard. And, of course, at that time, David Rockefeller had just been working in Europe on helping set up the European Union, what at that time was known as the European Coal and Steel Authority. And that would grow into the European Economic Community, then the European Community, and eventually the European Union, which was going to be visualized as the most important regional development, where nations would be merged together, and then all these various regional blocks that would be set up would be able to be merged into a world government. So David Rockefeller was working at that end, helping to using the Marshall Plan funds to help destroy Europe's sovereignty as a prelude to then doing it here in the United States. And he was also launching at that time similar operations throughout all of Latin America to create a North American and then a Western Hemispheric Union. So that's I might have gone a little afield, but that's some of what we've been writing about and telling the American people about. Almost uniquely, unfortunately, most of the other conservative groups, and even many of the constitutional groups, have really not paid much attention to the United Nations, other than to criticize it and say they're anti-American and the United Nations is not our friend. But it's a much more serious threat than that. And thanks to the John Birch Society and the New American Magazine, I was able to, and its predecessors, I was able to realize the danger and to join in exposing it. And the John Birch Society has almost uniquely been pointing out that it is the United States which is making this possible. Our prestige, our money, our participation in the United Nations is what makes it possible for the globalists to use it as a fulcrum that they can leverage all of their programs throughout all of the world. So we see in countries, all the countries that I've traveled to, third world countries, whatnot, you see a vast UN presence there. I saw you holding up before my sound came on the issue that we did of the New American on building the global government on the brink of becoming a global government. And it's very obvious when one goes to third world countries, you see the United Nations everywhere, the United Nations World Health Organization, UNESCO, UNICEF. All of these countries have become dependent upon the United Nations. So you see their tents there, you see their buildings there, you see their white vehicles and their white helmets and all of their personnel all over the place. And we are making it possible for the United Nations to be the indispensable institution in all of these third world countries. And so Americans often ask me, they say, well, why is it that in the United Nations there we're paying for all of this, and whenever they have a vote, it's about 199-1 there. They're always voting against us. And that was very apparent during the Cold War, when the Soviet Union and China and Cuba and other communist countries, openly communist countries, would join against us. But now, supposedly, the communist bloc is no longer a unified bloc. But we see still the same kind of anti-American, anti-Western, pro-socialist, pro-communist agenda reaping great rewards and being overwhelmingly supported at the UN. And that is because many of these countries are still communist. Many of them are socialist in that their ruling parties are members of the Socialist International, which, again, we've been almost unique in exposing at the New American. The Socialist International traces its lineage back to Karl Marx very proudly, and they have a very dominant role at the United Nations. They're very pro-communist, and so we see our tax dollars actually being used through the United Nations to build socialism worldwide. And that, of course, is not just a waste of our own tax dollars, which we could be using here, whether as tax dollars, but more importantly, if it were not being taken out of our pockets, we, the American people, American consumer, could do much more with it to improve not only our own lot, but as all studies have shown over and over again for decade after decade after decade, when it comes to actual helping hands, private charities, particularly through churches, but other private charitable groups, do far more good than any of the government programs. And that certainly is true with regard to the United Nations, where we have such an incredible, besides all the socialism, communism, subversion that we see going on there, we have incredible corruption, waste, and mismanagement and embezzlement. so that there are always ongoing scandals at the UN and prosecutions of people for embezzlement and mismanagement and corruption. But it never even touches on a fraction of the things that we've been reporting on there about what is accepted as official corruption and embezzlement and extortion there at the United Nations.
Well, Bill, I couldn't agree with you more on all this, but I want to bring Jack back into the discussion because there's an important link that I want to get into, and that is the fact that George C. Marshall and really the American leadership were essential in cutting the legs out from under Chiang Kai-shek, who was the leader of Free China, and were actually promoting Mao as the leader of China, and how that whole thing came together, and how we are, in fact, we were supposed to be supporting Taiwan as the member of the Security Council, the UN representative was supposed to be Taiwan, and then the whole thing got shifted over to Communist China. So now we have basically a whole bunch of socialist countries controlling the highest echelons of the UN. John, I want you to talk a little bit about how the United States and George C. Marshall were directly responsible for the fall of Free China right after World War II.
Well, Dan, the UN really wasn't very powerful at its initial founding, and that occurred in 1945. Mm-hmm. George Marshall was, of course, one of the insiders, we call them. We would call them deep state today, who was involved in the Truman administration and helping to build up the United Nations as the last great hope for peace. Now, I'm going to divert a little bit here and get into something that really riles me, and that is the UN is being taught in the schools of America as a peace organization. We've got to have the United Nations if we're going to have peace. All right? The U.S. Constitution is not taught in the schools of America, except in a few, and neither is the United Nations Charter. They're both about the same size. But you would think that if this peace organization, the United Nations, which is so heavily lauded in school books and textbooks, you would think that the Charter of the United Nations, the founding document for the United Nations, you would think that it would have been taught. It's not been taught, and there are reasons why it's not been taught. They say that they're a peace organization, but in Article 2 of the United Nations Charter, you find out that the Security Council can send forces here or there or wherever they want in order to enforce peace. Enforce is the word, and it's a very important word. Now, if you, Dan, or any of your listeners were United States senators back in 1945 when the U.S. Senate was asked to rule on whether we should join the United Nations, would you have signed on if you read the Charter and found Article 25? Article 25 is one sentence in the Charter of the United Nations. And it says, the members of the United Nations agree to accept and carry out the decisions of the Security Council in accordance with the present charter. Would you, as a U.S. senator, sign that? I doubt that you would, Dan.
No.
I doubt that.
No.
I know that Bill Jasper wouldn't. I wouldn't, and so on. But there were only two United States senators who saw that and saw it for what it was and voted against it. The vote against getting into the United Nations, the propaganda was so heavy that 89 senators voted yes, 2 voted no, and 3 weren't present. So incredibly. Now, again, go back to the fact that if the United Nations is so good, why don't we have the students study the United Nations? Well, if they study the United Nations, they would not only find that the members of the United Nations are committed to accept and carry out the decisions of the Security Council, they would find out that troops would be assigned and the United Nations would make the choice of which troops got to enforce the United Nations mandates. Have the American forces ever been required to enforce United Nations mandates? Well, they did a little bit of a tricky move here. The founders of the United Nations in 1949 started an organization called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. NATO still exists, all right? And what was NATO? NATO was an organization controlled by the United Nations. You read that in the Charter, Articles 51, 2, 3, and 4. It's all right there. And NATO has always been a creature of the United Nations. So what happened in Korea in 1950, 1 year after NATO was formed? Well, North Korean communist forces invaded South Korea, who were non-communist or anti-communist forces. President Truman sent America's military. Where did he get authorization to do that? The Constitution of the United States says only Congress can get us into war. Congress didn't vote to go to war in Korea. So where did they get the authorization to do that? Truman turned to NATO. He said, if I can send troops to NATO, I can send troops to Korea. And he did. So we lost 50,000 Americans in Korea, and the war ended, shooting ended in 1953. The war in Korea has never been settled. It could break out again tomorrow. All it was an armistice of sorts. And so all United States military forces who have ever served in Korea have served in a NATO command situation. Their boss has not been the government of the United States. Their boss has been the United Nations. Now go ahead, and where do we see next? Well, that was so successful, according to the leaders of the United Nations, they decided to start another similar organization called the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, SEATO. And it was under SEATO that we sent troops to Vietnam. But we told them that you weren't able to win the war. They didn't say it in so many words, but the orders that came down kept the United States forces from winning the war. American generals said we could have won the war in several weeks if they had let us do so. Right? Same thing happened in Korea. We could have won the war in weeks if they had let us do so. They didn't let us do so. But how many people in our country realized that the United Nations was behind stopping the U.S. military? Now, move on. We've now been in Afghanistan 19 years. I don't know how many Americans appreciate the fact that the commander of the military operation against the Taliban in Afghanistan is NATO, a United Nations organization, and they call the shots. Will America finally move out of Afghanistan? We certainly should, but we will not until the United Nations and NATO allow us to do so. Now, these kinds of things ought to be in the textbooks of the American school children, the high school children, even grade school children. They're not. And the Charter of the United Nations, which is no larger than the Constitution of the United States, ought to be studied by every American. I wrote a little book about it called America and the United Nations. It's only 50-some-odd pages long. And it goes into this. I've had people read that book and say, my golly, I never knew any of this. I never knew it. How come nobody ever told me? I said, now you think you might have come upon a conspiracy here? And they look at me and they say, yeah, it is a conspiracy to keep this kind of information from the American people. So I have a booklet. Bill has two books. I've written columns. I've written this. I've written that about the United Nations. We've spread this information all across our country, and we've slowed them down. We haven't slowed them to the point where the United States Congress will vote to get us out of the United Nations, but certainly that's what should happen. And I'll go get a drink of water and let Bill get back to taking over.
Well, one of the things I want to bring into this is the UN Charter, the human rights section under the UN Charter, that's virtually word for word identical to the 1936 Soviet Constitution.
Exactly, that's right. You're right about that.
And that section, John, that section delineates that rights come from government, not from God, and that they can rescind or take away those rights for the good of the collective. Now, isn't that really a phenomenal thing for people to know? Because the UN does that, and it's totally the opposite of what our Constitution and unalienable rights mean to us.
Well, very simply, the United States is built on a foundation saying men are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and governments are formed to protect those rights, right? And there's no escape from that. That's there. And that, of course, is not being taught in the schools of America. All right. You go to the United Nations. I've talked about the United Nations Charter, but the United Nations also has the Declaration of Human Rights, and they go into and they talk about the very same rights that you and I as Americans, all Americans, expect will be honored. The right to speak, the right to publish, the right to practice your religion, the right to keep and bear arms, and so on and so on. It's all in these United Nations Charters, but at the end of all of listing of all of these rights, it says none of these rights can exist if the United Nations abolishes them. They not only grant the right, they assume the right to abolish them. The United States Constitution says, here, you have rights from God, and nobody can take them away. No government, nobody. And that is extremely important. I'm glad you made me get into that, Dan. It is extremely important. And those rights that the UN talks about are not in the Charter of the United Nations. They're in subsequent documents published by the United Nations. The Declaration of Human Rights, for instance. That's where they say you have these rights, except if we pass a law that says you don't. And that's directly opposite the American system, which says you have rights given by God. They are unalienable. Nobody can take them away. Mm-hmm. That itself is reason to get out of the United Nations.
Well, it is, and I'm going to leave. I'm going to just let either one of you jump in on this. But the fact is, we have very ample evidence that Marx was a Satanist. There are books written by a minister who has actually spent 14 years in communist prison, and he wrote a book called Marx and Satan. There are a number of books about that, but it turns out that Karl Marx actually had written over 100 different publications and books, and one of those is a play that was dedicated to Satan, and in that play it said that he was going to destroy humanity and turn humanity over to Satan. Now that's right in his works, and the fact is that the communists have never let a lot of those works become public because they show a clear connection between Marx and Satanism, and what America stands for is a Christian love of mankind and a Christian foundation that was based on natural law and God's law, and that's what unalienable means. Okay, let's head that direction for a minute.
Well, let me start off and just say that American schools, up until the Supreme Court decision in the 1960s, started off with Bible reading and prayer. Every day in the schools of America started off with Bible reading and prayer. It was contested by the American Civil Liberties Union and several other pro-communist organizations. And it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court threw out the prayer that had been constructed by a Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, a Jewish rabbi. They had a small prayer. They got together and they said, here's the prayer that we would like to have the students say at the beginning of the school day in the schools. And it was the prayer that was in the state of New York. I know the prayer. I've told a lot of people about it. It says, Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence on thee, and we ask your blessings on ourselves, our family, our government, and our country. That's really subversive, isn't it? But that was thrown out by the American Supreme Court, where there were pro-communists in the bench at the time, and there have long been pro-communists. And we got a new president here named Trump, and Trump has appointed two men to the Supreme Court and pretty much changed what might come out of the Supreme Court, and we hope anyhow. And it's taken a long, long time to be able to find the people that would stand up for America at the Supreme Court level. So, Dan, what you're talking about is what I just tried to explain. And if you want to ask further questions about it, I'll be glad to entertain them.
Yeah, no, please do. I want to make the connection with what communism is. And it is, we have the statement a lot. I use it a lot on my radio program. And that is, we are in a fight between good and evil. Understanding that Marxism equates to Satanism, equates to a total destruction of the Christian faith, as well as every other faith, ultimately. And we need to understand that Christianity has no place in their world. So if we turn our country over to communism, we will see religion as we know it as something, a thing of the past, and we will lose what is so important as such an essential part of our Christian foundation to our country.
Well, we can lose our country not to communism. They'll call it something else. They'll call it socialism. They'll call it whatever. I was on a radio show one time, and a fellow said, "What's the difference between socialism and communism?" I said, "Well, a communist is a socialist in a hurry." Mm-hmm. Very simple.
I've used that myself, John. I know. Yeah, it's very simple.
Very simple, right? And you know, let's remember USSR. Was not the Union of Soviet Communist Republics. It was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And here we are in America today, where the leading candidate for the nomination to be president of the United States this year is an admitted socialist who on his honeymoon took his wife to Moscow during the Cold War. I mean, you see how poorly educated the American people are, that they would tolerate that they would vote for it, and so forth. I sit here in my home here in Massachusetts, and I say to myself, it's about time for the John Birch Society to start a movement to educate new voters, younger people, 18, 20, 30 years old, what socialism really is. And what it would mean for their future. All they have to do is look at Nicaragua, what happened there. Nicaragua, probably the most promising country for the wealth of the people and the good living that they had, was completely destroyed by socialists who are now fighting to maintain that socialism while the people are starving and the people can't get medicine and the people, you know, they've ruined the country. And they'll ruin our country, too, if we allow them to continue to do what the socialists always do.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. And certainly Venezuela, as well as Nicaragua, are obvious examples of how what a failure socialism really is.
Right. And did I say Nicaragua when I meant Venezuela?
Okay. Well, Nicaragua was certainly...
Nicaragua, even before Venezuela went... Before they destroyed the government system, mm-hmm. Venezuela was probably the most prosperous of all Latin American countries, mm-hmm. and look what's happened to it. We don't want that to happen to America, right? But it is happening. Excuse me. You've got to realize that there are powerful forces at work to bring about socialism in the United States. It would have taken a giant leap forward under socialism if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016. It will take a huge jump if Bernie Sanders wins in 2020 or some of the others in that fight going on in the Democratic Party right now. Now, the John Birch Society is not a political organization, and we didn't go around telling people to vote for this one or vote for that one. What we do is, here's the record of the people that you're being asked to vote for. Here's what they stand for. Here's what they've said. Here's what they do, and so forth. You've got to figure this out. If we persuade you that socialism is a good thing by simply listing all of what we consider to be bad about socialism, so be it. But we want the American people to know. And we want, especially for a lot of young Americans. Young Americans, when they grow up until the mid-40s or early 50s, they're no longer socialists. They know that America became great not because of what government did, but because of what government was prevented from doing by the Constitution. That's a very simple thought. And it's a very important thought, and we hope many more Americans will begin to realize it. Mm-hmm. Okay, Bill, it's your turn.
I want to mention Alex Newman, who is, I think, the best hope we have of educating young people and making them realize just how evil socialism is. Bill or John, I want you to talk about the difference between fascism and so-called communism, and I, what I tell people is the difference that I see is that fascism is national socialism, and communism is international socialism, but they're both opposite sides of the very same coin, and when they start calling people fascists, really the people that are doing the name calling, most of them are part of that whole program. Go ahead, one of you talk about that.
Well, let me just briefly say that what we're trying to do in the John Birch Society is preserve freedom and preserve American freedom, a republic with understanding the Constitution of the United States. That's the positive part of what the John Birch Society is all about. In the economic sphere, we try to get people to understand that oligarchical control over a productive system, the economic system, is all around us. It's surrounding all of the countries of the world, and it certainly has had its impact here in the United States. There are several kinds of socialism, one of them being fascism. Fascism is government control without government ownership. And we saw that happen in Italy, right? Mussolini didn't own the businesses. He simply told them what to produce and when to produce and how much to produce and who to hire and who to fire and what prices to charge. And he said, the rest is up to you. There was nothing left, right? So fascism was left-wing economic control of the capital and the business community. And then the next one is Nazism. We're being told, everybody in America is being told, the Nazis are right wing. No, they're not. They're left wing, right? Nazism, the word means National Socialism. That's where the acronym came from, National Socialism, right? And that, they went one step more than Mussolini. They owned some of the big businesses. They controlled the rest, and they were economic tyrants just as much as Mussolini was. Then you get to socialism, where the major industries are owned by the government. The medical industry would be government-owned. Power companies, the fuel companies, they would be owned by the government, right? And then you finally get to communism, which is all of the productive society is owned by the government and therefore all controlled. So you've got four forms of state monopoly: fascism, Nazism, socialism, and communism. And amazingly, communism is the only honest one. It says that it wants all capital owned by the state and all controlled by the state. The others have shadings of what they want. What is it that the communists want to do? They want to destroy private property. Go read the Communist Manifesto. They say, right, bluntly, our aim is to destroy the right to own property. Right? If you can't own property, you can't start a business. If you can't own property, you have to live at the government's behest, and so on. So what we've got here, we got an economic system that should be called a republic, not a democracy. Our founding fathers hated democracy, and it should be combined with freedom, competitive capitalism, where the capital is held privately and controlled privately. The opposite of that is an oligarchy, a group of powerful individuals who've taken control, and then they take control of the economic sense, and they have high prices, poor quality, shortages, no private property, and so on. So we've given a course in economics, and we've given a course here in political science, and now I'll turn it back to Dan and Bill.
Okay. Bill, I would like to mention the fact that Prince Philip was one of the original founders of the World Wildlife Fund, and he is quoted as a direct quote as saying that private property, and I guess I am going to have to paraphrase a little bit, private property is evil and should be ended for the good of mankind because it is a accumulator of wealth and power. Now, let's talk about that. How international communism, and incidentally, Philip is a communist. He was a communist when he lived in Greece. How they are also promoting the heck out of the rabid environmentalism that we're seeing today. Bill, are you there?
I think Bill went to get a drink of water.
Uh-oh, okay. Well, John, I guess I'll let you lead it a little bit, and then we'll turn it over to Bill when he gets back.
Okay. Well, you're talking about Princess Philip in England.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. He's head of the Wildlife Fund. That's UN connected. Their son is Charles, and Charles was a big buddy of Armin Hammer, who was a friend of all of the Soviet dictators, right from Stalin into Gorbachev and so forth. They're all peas in the same pod. Whether or not the next generation of the leaders in England are also connected with all of this stuff, I really don't know. I wouldn't say at the time. Bill probably would know.
John, I want to mention the fact that Al Gore Sr. and Al Gore were also huge friends of Arm & Hammer, and in fact, big stockholders in the petroleum company that Arm & Hammer established. And
Occidental.
Occidental, and they're all tied together at the hip, and they're all promoting the same kind of rabid environmentalism, and they're the big ones that are pushing the climate change initiative to try to shut down really private enterprise worldwide and put all global production of carbon under the control of the UN and use that as a funding mechanism for the UN. So let's talk about that.
Well, what we're facing is a different kind of initiative that would get the people to accept domination by government, all right? It was a military threat, and that's no longer a military threat. The military threat of the Soviets and possible nuclear war and so forth, that's pretty much gone by. The John Birch Society would take had taken a tremendous role in pointing out that whatever the Soviet Union had, we'd give them in the first place, and we should stop doing it. All right, so then they have to come up with new ideas to scare the people and to get them to accept total government. What are some of the new ideas? Well, the world is overpopulated. All right, that's what they're saying. And they've got to do something about this tremendous growth of population throughout the world, right? So you get somebody like Jacques Cousteau, the Frenchman who is an oceanographer, I guess they call them. And he's supposed to be a nice, sweet little guy just peddling around the world in his Calypso boat and so forth. But he wrote an article for the United Nations UNESCO magazine out of Paris. And in it, he said, it's a terrible thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, and that is we have to reduce the population. I think we have to eliminate 435,000 people per day in order to get from 7 billion people on Earth down to 1 billion. He actually said that, which means that he's not a nice little oceanographer. He's a savage, right? He's a UN savage. Mm-hmm. And the UN is the only organization I can think of that would publish something like his statement. And they did publish it. And I have a copy of it in the French UNESCO publication and a translation. So then what's the next thing that they're peddling now to get us and scare us into accepting world rule? Well, it's climate change, right? People ask me about climate change, and I said, yes, climate changes. One year you have a hot winter, next year you have a cold winter. One year you have a hot summer, next year you have a cool summer. It changes, and nobody is affecting that except God Almighty. Now, people are saying that, carbon dioxide is getting into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is food for plants. You've got to have carbon dioxide for the trees to grow and the crops to grow. You want carbon dioxide. More carbon dioxide is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Right.
And yet carbon dioxide has become the enemy of mankind. So now climate change. I saw recently where the screwball in America, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we call her AOC, by the way, AOC came out and said that in less than a decade, Miami's going to be underwater. The sea is going to rise 2.5 feet. Mm-hmm. She actually said that, right?
I know.
Now, if the sea rises 2.5 feet in Miami, it's going to rise 2.5 feet in New York, and it's going to rise 2.5 feet in London, and 2.5 feet everywhere else on Earth, and it isn't happening. It isn't even close to happening. Mm-hmm. The amount of water for 2.5 feet rise in Miami is enormous. It would mean that the oceans and the seas, wherever, would have to rise in order for Miami to be flooded at the coast, and it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Al Gore has said that we only have a decade, and he said that 3 decades ago. And yet he's made a lot of money out of peddling his screwball ideas. He wanted to do, in his book, An Inconvenient Truth, he wanted to do away with the internal combustion engine. Mm-hmm. Is he pro-UN? Does he want the UN to take over and rule mankind because of climate change worries? Of course. He goes to all the UN conferences. And then you've got stupid young females like AOC coming along and listening to the wrong people. Some of our people down in New York City area where she's from have tried to get through to her and tried to talk some sense into her. She's not interested. She's on a roll, and she's going to continue that roll. And now she's out supporting a man who is an identified socialist, self-confessed socialist, for president of the United States. Right? On and on we go. And the media doesn't tell the American people about it, and that's evidence of conspiracy.
Absolutely. Well, that's why we're talking about theory versus facts. Bill, I want you to weigh in on this discussion, because I know you've been to many of these conferences, and you know all about the attempts to use climate change to promote global government.
Is my sound back on?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. I must have toggled a switch on the screen somewhere. Sorry, but I couldn't get through the mute, apparently. Well, yes, you know, there are many things that come out of these UN conferences. But before I jump into that, make sure I get back to it. In the last segment, when I couldn't get back on, I was having the sound problems. There was a number of comments made that I just wanted to piggyback on, and one was your mention of Marx and Satan and Satanism, and the gentleman you were referring to, who wrote the book Marx and Satan, which is a very important book, is Reverend Richard Wurmbrand, who was tortured, wrote the book Tortured for Christ in Romania, and that is put together the research from many different sources, but one of the sources that he relied on a great deal was Robert Payne, who is an establishment historian and wrote a number of books, a couple of books on Marx's satanic fixation. And Marx wrote, going clear back to his youth, wrote poems to Satan and wrote anti-Christian stories and poems, one of them being The Holy Family, which was a profane attack on Christ and on his human family, and a way of foretelling his attack on the family, which we would see expressed in the Communist Manifesto, where he comes right out and says, you accuse us of a communist of attacking the family, of attacking marriage. Yes, we say it unashamedly. And he goes on to say that what is family and fatherhood, having a family other than a concubinage and slavery. And that's what we've seen in every communist country. They destroy the family. And that's why we see the communist, socialist, Marxist, leftists here trying to destroy the family in so many different ways, trying to destroy it by destroying the child itself through abortion. Then those children that aren't destroyed by abortion, that are not murdered, they try to murder their minds and souls by propagandizing them in the government schools, through their entertainment, through all the different propaganda fonts of social media that are out there. But this has been going on for generations. And then, of course, trying to destroy the family by making the family dependent upon the state, by increasingly promoting promiscuity so that we have single mothers without the without a fatherhood image in the family, a fatherhood model, and without the productivity and support of a husband and a father for the children. That's all. This is all being promoted in order to destroy the family, and it is satanic, both in the actual formal sense of the word as well as in the metaphorical sense of the word. Also, I heard on there during one of the segments reference to Nicaragua and Venezuela. But Nicaragua is, again, another example where we can show both the communists and socialist effects in action. The Sandinista government, which is now currently still running Nicaragua, I was there in 1989 when the transition came back away from the Sandinistas, when, you know, the Sandinista communists took power in 1979, overthrew Anastasio Somoza, and instituted their communist junta there, and Daniel Ortega became their eventually their president. Outright communist, a fraternal brother of Fidel Castro. He ruined the country for 10 years, and then Violeta Chamorro, who had been on the one of the Sandinista leaders and turned against him, briefly became president, and that's when I went down there for her inauguration. I met many of the governmental leaders, including her, at her home. I was the only journalist invited to her home the night before the inauguration, where all the cabinet members were there and all of the key people of the government. But thanks to our State Department, once again, the Sandinistas were helped into power and have been in control there now for the last 13 years. The Sandinistas there have ruined the country, ruined the economy. They are not as in as desperate straits as in Venezuela, but not a whole lot better. But one of the things that we learn from this, the Sandinistas, even though they call themselves Marxists, and many people refer to them as communists, they share many fascist characteristics as well. And one of the characteristics of fascism as a political and economic system is that it is often referred to as corporate socialism or corporate fascism. And that is, as John McManus explained, under fascism, the government doesn't own all of the land and the productive facilities and capital outright. It doesn't own it all, but it controls it all. And that's what we see with the Sandinistas and many of the other communist and socialist regimes. They recognize that fascism is more efficient in that if we allow people to have a little bit of property, they'll do more themselves. And if we have all of our big corporate ownership of all these major industries and infrastructure and means of production with our corporate cronies, then we can have socialism. But some of the beneficial features of capitalism as well. But what in all of those systems, what is critical to them, and this is what we see in the United Nations with all of their sustainable development and everything else, the key issue here is central planning. Central planning. We're going to have this brain trust of so-called experts that are going to plan everything for everybody. And so we see when this was implemented here in the United States under the New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his Secretary of Labor, Frances Perkins, wrote in her book about her memoirs. She says, during our first cabinet meeting, Roosevelt and I believe it was Harry Hopkins came in. Anyway, she said a copy of Gentile's Fascist State was handed around to everybody at the first cabinet meeting. And all of the New Deal Democrats, the brain trusters and everything, they were very high on Mussolini and on all of the key fascist thinkers and economists. They believed in that central planning, that we have, that we can't just allow the market to run itself, and that millions of people making independent decisions all on their own can bring about a prosperity and a profusion and of goods and services that people want. To them, that's chaos. It has to be controlled by someone. Of course, that's the way communists, socialists, Marxists all think. And they want, of course, they want to be the ones that are going to be doing the central planning and calling the shots and ordering everybody else to march to their tune. But then to get back to your question, which I've temporarily forgotten, what was that, Dan?
Well, we were talking about the connections between in rabid environmentalism and what's going on with communism.
Well, yes, and so here again we see if you look around the world, where is the worst environmental degradation taking place? I mean, even many of the liberals, lefties, environmentalists acknowledge that China is the worst place in the world right now for air pollution. I mean, anytime you go to Beijing or if you look at any of their major cities, everybody is wearing masks of one kind or another to protect against the air pollution. You can't even see across town, and some days are barely across the street because the air pollution is so bad in this wonderful communist paradise. And that's just one aspect of it, that which is most visible. But their rivers and streams and lakes and their coastal areas have all been different. Many, many different programs and studies done showing how terrible that is there. And it was the same during the Soviet Union when communism was openly running Russia and the Soviet Union. One of my in my book on global tyranny, Step by Step, for instance, I quote from that book, Ecocide, which was written by two liberal left environmentalists. And what Ecocide focuses on the environmental destruction and degradation taking place in the Soviet Union and in the communist bloc countries, unlike anything you saw anywhere in the West. And why is that? Because the central planners have no consequences. Here in the United States, even a major corporation, because we have property rights, they're being eroded all of the time. But traditionally here, because we have property rights, if somebody is polluting the stream upstream from me, I, as a property owner, I'm a rural property owner. I have acreage out here in the country, whatnot. But whether a property owner or a city dweller, we have property rights. And if somebody is violating the air or the water or other ways, harming our property rights, we have a right to sue in court. And we have every day there are suits like this against polluters. And not only that, but we have regulations here at the state and local level that they are not bound by that in communist China or in any of the other communist or socialist countries. The government can go ahead and or its designated corporate cronies can pollute. They don't have to get an environmental impact statement to rip up the ground, the level of forest, to do any of those things that here property rights would. The government has to go to court if they want to take my land and use it for some to build a new city like they've just done in China over the last 20 years. A couple dozen mega cities have been built where once there were fishing village, farming village, or whatnot. They just come in, take over, mow down all the crops, all the forests, bring in bulldozers, bulldoze everything, and within a few years, you have a city of 10 million people. They can just do that because they're the government, and they have no restrictions upon them. We can't do that here. And so that's why you see everywhere the communists are in power. We have environmental degradation on a scale far in excess than you see in any countries that have anything resembling a free market.
No, you're right, Bill. And I want to bring another point into that because you're touching on it right now. And that is the fact that the biggest polluters in the world by far are communist and socialist countries, especially the People's Republic of China. And yet they get a free pass by the UN, and not only do they get a free pass, but they're actually kind of the darlings of the UN. And the UN is turning more and more leadership positions over to the communist Chinese. Isn't that a pretty darn good indication that the UN is a communist organization, and it isn't about the environment, it's about communism taking over the world?
Well, yes. I mean, that is one of the really incredible stories. And you mentioned earlier Alex Newman. Alex, I'm so glad that he has taken over a lot of my former functions of attending these UN meetings and following the UN, because after doing it for several decades, I needed a break from that. I'm not that much of a masochist that I wanted to keep doing that, but he is doing a wonderful job. And one of the areas that he has really reported on extensively and excellently is on communist China's huge, huge inroads into the leadership positions of the United Nations. He's done a number of stories on it. I have as well, on all of the various leadership positions throughout the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the Food and Agricultural Organization, UNESCO, many other branches of the UN, where communist China's Communist Party members have been put in charge or in high-level positions there and at the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. This, again, shows the very real nature of what we have been reporting on for decades, that the United Nations is not just dominated by the communist countries and their delegates, but it is promoting communism in just about every one of its programs. And when we look, for instance, at the attempt by the United Nations to take over the internet, communist China has put its people in charge there. The United Nations welcomes them there. When it comes to control over the world food supply at the FAO, communist China, they really wanted to get in control there, and it worked. So when it comes to the environment, again, we should ask, why is it that China is given a pass? Why is it that they are considered by the UN to be an undeveloped country or a developing country? They have one of the largest economies in the world, second only to us. They have trillions of dollars, supposedly, in reserves, and yet we are giving them, still, our State Department and various of our agencies are giving them special treatment, actually giving them loans. It's unbelievable that we could do this. And so this is one of the things that President Trump has called the United Nations on and the World Trade Organization just recently. He said, hey, look, this isn't right that China gets a break on this at the World Trade Organization, that they get breaks on things that other countries don't. They're using all of the breaks that we give them and the money we give them, they turn right around. They're using all this money. They're giving hundreds of billions of dollars to various countries in Africa and in Latin America, and it's certainly not just out of the goodness of their hearts. They're getting something in return for it. So when we give them special treatment and we allow them to get off the hook and we saddle our own energy producers and our own manufacturers with stifling regulations, then we're helping communize our country and we're helping the communists escape from the consequences of their own policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Bill, they're when they're giving those hundreds of billions of dollars to different countries around the world, they are also at the same time buying all the natural resources of the world. And they control some very, very key areas that are important to our national defense and other industries. And when you mentioned the fact that the communist Chinese government is the number two economy, but they are far and away the biggest polluter in the world now. Isn't that true?
Oh, yes, very much so. In fact, they are ordering, while we're being told we have to close down all of our coal plants, even our more modern advanced coal-fired power plants, they're ordering dozens of them. Mm-hmm. They have China and India, and India is another socialist country. It's not as quite as bad as China, but India and China account for, I did a story on it just recently, but I won't try to quote the figures because I'd probably get them wrong, but China and India account for a huge percentage of all the new coal-fired plants that are going up. And a lot of their coal-fired plants still use bad technology in terms of pollution. So, there's a huge double standard there, and they will say, well, China and other countries they need to be compensated because they have to catch up because they have a long ways to go. Well, as we said, China has been helped for the last four decades, and particularly in the last three decades, with a huge transfer, like something we've never seen before in human history. The only time we've seen it before is when conquering armies come in and take all of the loot from one country and take it back home. We've never seen anything before where a country strips itself of its manufacturing base and technology base that took generations to build. That's what we've seen here in the last 30 years. And we've been writing about it, documenting it at the New American. It's come out in some of the other media too, but most of them say, oh, it's wonderful. It's part of this new free trade agenda, that globalization that's going to make us all wealthier. We don't need those old Rust Belt manufacturing and technology. Well, you know what? When it comes time to fight for your existence, when you need bullets and tanks and planes and drones and things that are actually made out of material things, they don't just materialize by magic from CGI. You can't just conjure them up by DreamWorks or some of these Hollywood productions. You actually have to have real on the ground brick and mortar manufacturing. You actually have to take things out of the ground, take minerals out of the ground, take minerals out of the sea. You have to grow things to feed your armies and to feed your population. That comes out of the ground. Those are resource industries that have all been under attack by all of the so-called greenies, who really aren't greenies at all. They are really pinkies or reds, because most of what they're calling for is socialism, and most of it is not conducive to sound environmental practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very definitely that way. Our producer, Thumper, had a question that he wanted to ask one or both of you gentlemen. Thumper, do you want to come on and ask that question, or you want me to do it?
Well, actually, that's a question from one of the folks out in the live chat.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And if you want to go ahead with that, Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, I sure will. Okay. They want to know about you to comment on Larry McDonald and the work that he did with J. Edward Griffin on the and the shooting down of the Korean Airline flight 007. Do you know anything that you want to comment on that?
Well, there's a lot that we could say about it. First of all, for many of your listeners may not know who we're referring to. We're talking about Congressman Lawrence P. McDonald, known to most of us as Larry McDonald. He is a medical doctor, a surgeon, and a very brilliant man. I worked with him. Jack McManus worked with him also. He became the chairman of the John Birch Society, and he was chairman when he was shot down on the Korean Airlines flight 007, flying from Alaska over to Seoul, Korea. And he was shot down by a Russian MiG. And it is important to know, I believe he was shot down, that the plane was shot down knowing that he was on board, and that's precisely why the plane was shot down. What was he going to Korea for? He was going there for a meeting of the World Anti-Communist League. Larry McDonald, besides being chairman of the John Birch Society, my colleague, your other guest on here, Jack Maness, has been president of the Birch Society. He's now president emeritus, and he'll correct me if I get any of the details wrong here. But Larry McDonald was also recognized as one of the most important political figures and conservative figures, patriotic figures, constitutional figures in the world at that time. He was still a very young and vigorous man, and very brilliant. And he had become he was on the boards of well over a dozen different conservative organizations, and he was on the House Armed Services Committee. I believe he might have even gotten chairmanship there for a while, or was vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Anyway, he was one of the most respected members of the House of Representatives at the time. And he was also very important, and I worked with him in this capacity, with the Western Goals Foundation. The Western Goals Foundation was a foundation that he set up to accomplish a number of different things. One of the things that he wanted to do was to try to reestablish privately one of the functions of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, and other House intelligence operations, which had been tasked with bringing the America, investigating communist operations in the United States and the threat of communist and subversive activities throughout the United States. And I was involved with him at that time just as a just out of college in the 1970s, I went undercover to Communist Party USA meetings, Communist Revolutionary Communist Party, the Socialist Workers Party, the Trotskyite and Marxist and Maoist communist organizations, primarily on the West Coast. And what I and others like me did was gather this information, the things that investigators for these House and Senate committees used to do, and then we put all of this information together and then put it on computer. And so Larry McDonald was one of the first members of the House to recognize that we needed to computerize all of this stuff back in the early days of computers, and to put all of this information together so that we could make intelligent and important decisions on national security and intelligence matters. And he brought together some very important and distinguished people onto the board of Western Goals Foundation, people such as General George Patton III, General Patton's son, a number of other people like Admiral Thomas Moore, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and others like that who were prominent Americans, and we were our goal was to try and do what government entities had been doing, but during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the Communist Party and all its adjuncts and all of the media had taken upon themselves the task of destroying all of these important committees and making it, that's where they just kept harping on McCarthyism, McCarthyism, McCarthyism. It's terrible, terrible, terrible. And of course, Joe McCarthy was a good man, a good patriot, and he was exposing all of this, which now we know from the Venona intercepts and whatnot, that everything that Joe McCarthy said was right, and how he did went about doing it was right. One of the big lies that Joe McCarthy did all these terrible things and he destroyed people's lives, that's all false. We were dealing with one of the worst conspiracies in history, the communist conspiracy, and Joe McCarthy did what was right, and Larry McDonald was trying to do the same thing, to do what was right, to expose our enemies, and that is why and Larry McDonald had to be taken out of the picture. He was attacked in Pravda, in Trud, in Izvestia, all of the top communist newspapers out of Russia, but he was attacked by all the communist and leftist papers here in the United States and the leftist fake news media. But he still forged ahead and was making progress. And finally, when all of the character assassination didn't work, I believe that is why the plane was shot down to take him out of the picture permanently.
Bill, let's not forget that there were 280 people aboard that plane, and not one of them has ever been seen again.
Yes, and so one of the outcomes of that, of course, is that President Reagan at the time made a speech condemning the Soviet Union for doing this, didn't even mention Larry McDonald, and then we kind of went back to business as usual. Mm-hmm. The same as when George H.W. Bush uttered a few words of indignation after Tiananmen Square, and then we went back to business as usual. So they knew that, okay, this is a terrible thing. They shot down a plane with a congressman and a bunch of other Americans and foreign nationals on board. George Shultz was, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was Secretary of State at the time. But George Shultz was basically the one who formed the official U.S. response to that. And so you can see these guys getting together and going, okay, well, American people are going to be mad. We're going to have to say something kind of strong, but we don't want to offend the Soviets too much. And that was actually, we found out that was exactly what happened after Tiananmen Square. I just recently wrote an article, which is in the current issue of the magazine, about Hong Kong. But in there, I talk about George H.W. Bush after the Tiananmen Square. And he sent two of his lackeys over to Beijing, say, hey, look, we've got to say something strong about this, but don't get too upset. We still want to have a healthy relationship with China. And so George Bush issued a statement, and the communists in Beijing knew that, okay, he has to say this for public consumption, but it's not going to affect us. It's not going to hurt us. We're not going to have any policies really change after people forget and the anger dies down. We'll just keep going merrily along our way, and that's what happened. We suspected, we knew that's That's what had happened. But it was many years later when the State Department memos were released and under Freedom of Information Act, and then we find out that's precisely what happened. Mm-hmm. Bush says, okay, yeah, we got to give the American people something. They're going to want us to be angry, so we'll be angry. But tell Deng Xiaoping that, hey, we'll be back working things together again very soon.
Mm-hmm. That is exactly the level of corruption that we see worldwide in our government, in world government, and we see it in our government. And thank goodness Donald Trump, it looks like, at least is attempting to expose some of that. Gentlemen, I hate to say it, but we're about out of time. Bill or John, I'd like to have both of you maybe talk a little bit about how people can learn more about the Birch Society, and then we'll wrap the show up.
All right, well, let me do that. This is John. Contact the Birch Society, P.O. Box 8040, Appleton, Wisconsin. Ask for information, or you go on the internet, jbs.org. Go to thenewamerican.com. I even write articles for thenewamerican.com. I'd be happy to have anybody ask me about why I'm writing this or that and so forth. We're an open book. We look forward to hearing from people anywhere, and we'd be glad to send you information and hope that you might want to join the John Birch Society's educational effort to wake the town and tell the people and to keep our country free. Bill, you want to add something to that?
Well, I think you've said it all. Yes, do go online. And if you will make the New American and or the John Birch Society your homepage, that helps us. Every time you open up, we get a click, and all of those things help. You need to get us. If you use social media, like our articles on your social media pages, and if you email, then email out our articles to people. And President Trump said it, the fake news media, New York Times, CNN, he named a few of them, are the enemy of the American people. That's why we've been going into bondage. And so the New American, the John Birch Society, we've proved ourselves over 60 years that we have a record, and we have one that we can stand on. We've been solid. We've been there. We've been accurate, and we continue to do so. So visit the New American and jbs.org, and let's take our country back. Thank you.
I agree, gentlemen, and thank you again for being our guests on this show. If we haven't done a great deal to dispel the idea that the John Birch Society stands for anything other than truth and liberty, then we've not done our job.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
It was 1776 when the founders signed the writ of independence from the Brits. It was revolution. Now an enemy from within would enslave us all again and deprive us of our rights in the Constitution. Restore the Republic. Wake up, it's time to understand. Restore the Republic. We're losing our freedom in the land.